A mild day in most places in the brightest of the weather, getting up into the high teens, more typically low to mid-teens. But again, across the north of Scotland, that cold air hangs on with a strengthening easterly wind. Now, looking ahead to the weekend, the cold air continues to hang on across the far Northern Isles, and we'll see some heavy rain too. So fairly bleak across the north of Scotland, certainly through Saturday, some wet and windy weather here. We'll all see some rain actually during the course of the weekend. It'll always be most prevalent across the more northern and western areas, but even further south and east we'll see some sharp showers from time to time. In any brighter spells, again, it'll be relatively mild across the more southern and central areas. It is just the far north of Scotland where that cold air will continue to hang on. And with that, I'll hand you back to Luke.
John, thank you. Now on Radio 4, Heston Blumenthal and Hugh Dennis continue their reading from Historic Heston. And a 17th century passion for a fashionable fruit inspires our 21st century chef to go to work on a new dessert in his development kitchen.
The English Cookery Book, 1858. Tipsy Cake. Take a stale sponge cake of full size. Pierce it with holes, making them with a knitting pin. Pour over by degrees, with a spoon, half a pint of raisin wine and a wine glass of brandy mixed. When this quantity is soaked up, stick it thickly over with blanched almonds cut in spikes. Just before it goes to table, pour over it a thick custard or whipped cream. For pineapple cream, infuse some foreign pineapple, cut in slices in boiling cream.
Amid the 17th century splendour of Ham House by the River Thames in Richmond, there hangs a painting by Hendrik Dankertz from about 1670 entitled Rose the Royal Gardener Presenting to Charles II the First Pineapple Grown in England. The painting used to be taken as evidence of the first pineapple cultivated here, but there's no written record of the epic event, nor of pineapples being grown in England at that time. The painting is a piece of theatre designed to show the king in the company of a rising star. The pineapple was a product of England's newly acquired colonies in the West Indies. Teaming the so-called King of Fruits with the king was a deliberate reminder of his dominion over the islands and his active endorsement of trade there, which was steadily improving English prosperity. The first presentation of the pineapple at court is mentioned in John Evelyn's diary.
I first saw the famous Queen Pine, brought from Barbados, presented to His Majesty.
Evelyn's diary is one of the best records we have of the Stuart age. It's also invaluable to anyone interested in cuisine, because Evelyn wasn't just a diligent diarist, but he was also a keen gardener and talented cook. And this brief entry marks the beginning of what was to become an English obsession with the pineapple. The earliest record of cultivation from scratch is a painting by Theodore Netcher, now in the Fitzwilliam Museum in Cambridge. And it shows a plump, spiky specimen that seems almost to float above an abundance of thick green leaves spreading out in every direction. A Latin inscription reads,
To the perpetual memory of Matthew Decker, Baronet, and Theodore Netcher, Gentleman, this pineapple, deemed worthy of the royal table, grew at Richmond at the cost of the former and still seems to grow by the art of the latter.
At the time, the difficulty involved in growing a pineapple in Europe was enormous. The plants only flourish in temperatures above 16 degrees centigrade and need not only warm air, but also warm soil and high humidity to survive. In our inhospitable climate, they could only be grown in a pit called a hotbed or in a special type of hothouse known as a stove. Now, these were highly, highly technical affairs. The hotbeds of Decker's gardener, Henry Teeland, were brick-lined pits filled with rubble and hot dung, which was the traditional method of providing a constant source of warmth. One of Teeland's innovations was to fill the rest of the pit with tanner's bark, which is ground oak bark that fermented like dung but it held on to its heat much longer than manure did and smelt a lot less offensive. Throughout the summer, pineapple suckers or crowns were plunged in the hotbed. In October, they were transferred to a stove of equally elaborate construction, with underfloor heating, glazed coverings and ingenious arrangements of flues and chimneys, and the thermometer was regularly and anxiously scrutinised until spring, when the plants would be returned to the hotbeds. And so the process would continue for the 2 to 3 years it took to produce fruit. The expense involved in all of this was just colossal. It's been estimated that each fruit cost the equivalent of £5,000. The homegrown pineapple had now become the ultimate luxury. By 1770, the botanist Richard Weston reported,
"No garden is now thought to be complete without a stove for raising of pineapples."
Given the Victorian zeal for feats of engineering on a grand scale, it'll come as no surprise that they too were attracted to the challenge of producing the fruit. During George Stephenson's semi-retirement, the inventor of the rocket locomotive devoted all his time to constructing a large pine house and pit at his home in Staffordshire, with the aim of growing pineapples as big as pumpkins. But then, in 1845, the abolition of the glass tax put hothouse cultivation within the reach of the middle classes. And in 1864, when the orange groves in the Azores succumbed to disease, the plantation owners switched to pineapples. Transportation from the Azores was quicker and cheaper than it was from the West Indies. So soon pineapples came to be seen as commonplace. The homegrown pineapple soon became a thing of the past. When it appears in print as a series of precisely described steps, a recipe always looks as though there was an inexorable logic behind its creation. Sometimes recipe development really is like that. You have a clear mental picture of the dish and a reasonable idea of the techniques that might accomplish it. Often, though, development is a much more haphazard business. It's like piecing together an old jigsaw that you found in the shoebox. There's no picture to guide you, nor any guarantee that you're going to have all of the pieces. All you can do is work on whatever separate bits make sense in the hope that a moment of inspiration will eventually bring them all together. My recipe for Tipsy Cake was one of these. It grew out of John Henry Walsh's 1858 recipe, a rotisserie and something served up at Fat Duck staff lunches, though at the start I had no notion that these things might belong together. And at that point, pineapple, which eventually became the showpiece of the dish, wasn't part of my thinking at all. Tipsy cake was a popular 19th century dessert that appears in many Victorian cookbooks, including Mrs. Beaton's, where it's illustrated by an engraving of an ornate, two-handled, twisted-stemmed cake dish surmounted by a cloud-shaped mound of the stuff. Clearly related to the trifle, it was essentially a method of using up leftover or stale sponge cake by lacing it with alcohol and smothering it with cream. Naturally, it was the dish's wonderful name that first caught my eye, conjuring up the surreal image of a drunken dessert. I was sure the name would be an intriguing prospect on dinner's menu, and the basic ingredients offered a good base for a dish, so long as I could bring some refinement to it. The first spark of inspiration, however, came from something that wasn't refined at all. For staff meals, one of the chefs started making monkey bread, which is a breakfast pastry made from segments of dough topped with butter, sugar, and cinnamon, to give it a caramelised flavour as it bakes in the oven. Monkey bread has been around in America since at least the 1970s, but this was totally new to me. I really liked the crisp, caramelised crust, and it sent me thinking that this might be a great template for Tipsy Cake. The little cluster of balls of dough looked appealing, and that crust provided not just depth of flavour, but also a great texture contrast. The staff lunch monkey bread was made with focaccia dough, but I looked at many different types of bread and eventually settled on brioche. Its high egg and butter content give it a soft crumb and a richness that makes it a superb vehicle for caramelization. It also has a beautiful, flaky golden crust, which was just what I was looking for. And gradually I developed a technique for accentuating the crisp, caramelized texture dipping frozen balls of dough in melted butter and golden caster sugar, then putting them in their little cast iron cooking pots and allowing them to prove for several hours. As the dough expands, the sugar coating crazes a little like a crackle glaze, enhancing the flakiness. It was important, too, to keep the alcohol in check. Walsh's half pint of raisin wine and a glass of brandy might have softened up an old sponge nicely, but it would have packed quite a punch, overshadowing the rest of the dish. Wine can be a fantastic enhancer of flavour, so I wanted to keep it in the recipe. The winemaking method in the Sauternes region of France produces the ultimate raisin wine, Sauterne, which is sweet with touches of caramelised fruit and toasted or even floral notes. It seemed ideal. However, although this was a tipsy cake, I didn't want it to have a huge hit of booze, so instead of soaking the brioche in alcohol at the start, I chose to add periodic doses of a mixture of sugar, cream, Sauterne and brandy during the cooking process. This gave me the control and subtlety of flavour I was looking for, and a quick final brush with brandy just before serving added just the right amount of freshness and intensity. So I now had a dish that was ready to go on the menu, but still I had no thought of pineapple in connection with it. However, in dinner's kitchen, I also had an amazing clockwork spit roasting device, which eventually brought the two together. Even when the plans for dinner were at the drawing board stage, I'd been determined that the place should have a rotisserie, not least as an homage to the time when English were considered the masters of the art of roasting by the rest of Europe. The designer Adam Tahani created a beautiful piece of equipment that somehow managed to look modern and traditional at the same time. Heavy wrought iron loops revolving patiently before a stainless steel grate powered by a gigantic watch mechanism encased in glass. The rotisserie looked spectacular and I put it centre stage in the kitchen. The problem was that I wasn't sure at first how best to make use of it. Roasting meat was the obvious option, a cut of beef perhaps, since the French did nickname us Les Rousse Beef in deference to our skill at the spit. But it wasn't very practical because spit roasting doesn't allow the chef as much control as other cooking methods. Now this was less of a problem for the medieval cook, because all the guests at the banquet would be eating at the same time. In a modern restaurant, however, with a stream of orders throughout service, it would be incredibly hard to spit roast meat to a consistently high standard. Then I remembered a visit to the food historian Ivan Day, at which he'd served up a dessert of pineapple larded with vanilla sticks. It was roasted on an old-fashioned rotisserie. How this failed to come to my mind before, I just don't know. But as soon as I thought of it, I knew I found just what I was looking for. A row of whole pineapples slowly twisting in midair presented a surreal picture that was far more eye-catching and original than a cut of meat. Once I started thinking along these lines, it wasn't long before I realised that pineapple might be a perfect accompaniment for tipsy cake. When John Evelyn first tasted the fruit, he described it almost as if it were wine.
It has yet a grateful acidity, but tastes more of the quince and melon.
The intense sweetness of a ripe pineapple can indeed be intoxicating. I could see how it might complement the Sauterne in the cake, and how roasting the fruit would give it a slightly caramelised flavour which would sit beautifully with the brioche. So that's how tipsy cake is served, with a strip of rich, sticky, golden-coloured pineapple as a decorative, delicious garnish. And customers, it seems, are as captivated by the vision of pineapples on the spit as I was. It's become an iconic image for the restaurant, and I'd like to think that in its own small way, it gives the pineapple back a little of the sense of spectacle it once had.
Service, please. 3 tipsy cakes for table 5. Go.
Heston Blumenthal and Hugh Dennis have been reading from Historic Heston. The programme was abridged and produced by Jane Marshall Productions for BBC Radio 4.